Welcome back to the Infinite Creators Podcast. I have a gentleman by the name of Seamus Fox on this episode. Seamus he's from Derry, and he works a lot in the wellness and fitness industry. He has his own gym there, and it's not only about just the physical aspect of life. He is very much focused on creating a better life for each of his clients and installing a really good mindset, you know, and I'm looking forward to diving into this podcast to get to know Seamus, to like actually get to know what it was that transformed him and changed from his wild youth of just partying and, you know, like a lot of young guys do, and how he's transformed into being someone who's a leader now and is holding space for, you know, men and women that gives them the opportunity to step in and be a better version of themselves. So I look forward to this conversation, and I hope you enjoy it. Seamus Fox, how are you?
I'm good, man. I'm good, Ryan. How are you?
Keeping well. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
So I've come across you recently through an uncle of mine, and he's been telling me about the bit of work you've done. And, you know, when I heard about you, I was like, geez, this man sounds very interesting, you know, and done a bit of research, and I've seen a little bit of your journey. And I think for me now, just I would really like to dive into where it all began for Seamus. You know, if you could bring me back to your earliest memories or the memories that kind of stick out and the ones that were challenging, and just going from there, if you don't mind, Seamus.
Yeah, 100%. I grew up in Gaelia, which isn't too far from here in Derry. The youngest of seven. I grew up in the 80s, 90s. I was in school. I actually spoke about this. I actually wrote a post, that I was going to post about school, so we can deep dive a wee bit more into that. But I suppose, who am I? Well, I'm a coach, father, I am a husband, and I've been involved in health and fitness and coaching for the last 20 years, but it kind of started from when I was around 21. But my earliest memories are probably just running around the street in Gaelia, playing football. Always loved football, always loved being involved in sport of some sort. Kind of dabbled a wee bit in boxing as well too. But yeah, earliest memories are probably just like being in the street playing, being in the street playing football, out and around doing those types of things, being a young kind of boisterous boy, as you do, like getting into trouble sometimes. Yeah.
So you would say that you were messing about a bit when in your younger years?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, 100%. I think at that time in the 80s and 90s, there was no phones, there was no computers, there was nothing to get to keep yourself entertained. You weren't stuck inside, which was a good thing and a blessing looking back. Because it got me really, really involved in health and fitness, I suppose. It got me really involved in sport. And in Gaelia, we just kind of ran around the Gaelia. We were up to all sorts and up to no good a lot of the times when we started getting a wee bit older. But the very younger, earlier years, I think, was more so just kind of out in the street playing football. I'd have played with football all day long. Like, my and dad had to fight to get me in to eat me dinner. It was one of those scenarios. So it was always kind of in and around football. That was my main love at that time, yeah.
Yes. And, you know, as a youngster growing up, what did you see, or how did you envision life? You know, what was it going to be like, say, as a teenager? What, had you dreams, or, you know, where were you planning to go?
I think in my delusional self when I was younger, I thought I was going to be a footballer. Didn't have the talent enough to be a footballer, but it was something that I really loved. I wanted to be, I wanted to do that. That was like, my head was set in that. And at that early age, that's kind of all I was really involved in, or all I really focused on. I didn't really focus on anything else. I wasn't in and around an environment that talked about goals or like, here's who you should become and this is what you need to do. And that just wasn't our house at all. Like, my parents were, like, I grew up with parents that were unemployed. We lived in benefits. No, it was never an environment that was like productive to actually like going on and being somebody and that type of thing. And that wasn't right or wrong either. That was the way it was, and I'm grateful for it. But it just wasn't that thing. I just didn't have that type of outlook. Definitely didn't have it in school, for sure. School was something that I just didn't get. I just couldn't get it. I just didn't understand it. It wasn't something that I got excited about or felt inspired about. And we can touch on that if we go through the podcast and understanding like human values and why those things happen. But it took me years and years and years of kind of self-discovery to look back and see why those things kind of were the way they were and how they shaped themselves and how that ended up shaping me as well too.
Yeah, so leading from that then, you know, not having goals, or not that we have to have goals either, you know. I know that they can help. You dreamt of being a footballer, like a lot of kids. There was a part of me one time it felt that too, like, but just didn't have the ability. Yeah. But coming through your, I suppose, your later teenage years then, you know, how did life unfold then?
I suppose teenage years, there again, just kind of left school maybe in and around the start of fifth year. I was floating in and out. I remember actually saying to my dad at the time, I hate school, I says, I just don't see any point. And my dad just says, look, he says, if you want to go, go. If you don't want to go, don't go. So being that age, I didn't go. Take a week off, go back and show my fish for a week, kind of keep things sweet. And that's how fifth year kind of went. Didn't sit any exams, left as kind of as quick as I could once I knew that school was over, and try to kind of map out a path. I was on a YTP scheme with, it was a group in Edmondson at the time, and they sent kind of, they sent guys that were involved in sport, football for me, up to Coleraine. So I was up doing a wee bit of football up there with Coleraine. Left at 17, met a girlfriend at that time, first girlfriend, thought I was in love, left sport behind. And then after that, then I kind of started experimenting with drugs and the party scene and, you know, the recreational party scene and the rave scene and stuff at that time, 17, 18. All my friends and everybody else was doing that. Like, so at that time when I left school, you kind of think you know where you're going to go, or things are just going to pan out the way you want them to pan out. But looking back, they didn't. Started out as an apprentice joiner, and then I started doing roofing, and then I was concreting, and you name a job, I've done it. And then that led me on to, I got a job in the markets then. So I was selling like counterfeit goods, cigarettes and tobacco and all those types of things all around the markets in Northern Ireland. Mm. Basically trying to make a pound, Ryan. That's basically what I was trying to do, trying to make a pound. In my head, I was thinking, right, I don't have any qualifications, didn't finish school, I'm definitely not getting a trade, I don't want to be a joiner or do anything like that. Right, what can I do to make a few pound and help me basically survive? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'd moved out of the house when I was 17. So I was kind of living on my own. I was like, right, I need to get a job and I need to earn some money and I need to find my way in doing that. So that was what presented itself at that time. And then that's what I was doing for a few years. But that ended up in a whole handling a lot of the times through like police and arrests and all sorts, which we can touch on. Like,
yeah, like when you say arrests, like what would you been arrested for?
Well, because I was selling counterfeit goods, I shouldn't have been doing it. So I was getting arrested for that. I'll tell you a story, and this is no like word of a lie. The first day I got this job, for the want of a better word, like, and I had to drive a car full of goods to the market. The markets was in Oma at the time. They're not there now. I don't think they are anyway.
What kind of goods?
Cigarettes, tobacco, CDs, counterfeit CDs and stuff. The boot was full. Like.
Yeah.
So I was young, naive. I think I was probably about 18 or something. And I was getting paid a few quid to do this, do the day on the market, driving up the road and trying to be inconspicuous, basically, cruising along, thinking everything was okay. Heard the sirens flying. I was like, some boy's getting it. Like, but they pulled in behind me. This is my first day. Pulled in behind me. Questioned me, arrested me, took me to the police station, gave me a warning, etc., blah, blah, blah. And that was my introduction, basically, into that job and career. Mm. But I stayed in that for the next couple of years because I didn't really see a different path, you know what I mean? I was just doing that. I was getting money and it was handy and it was adventurous, let's say. It was a wee bit risky, and when you're young and kind of, I wouldn't say stupid, but when you're young and maybe impressionable and you're thinking you're getting a few quid and you haven't really got a better alternative there at that time, it was okay to do. Like.
Yes, yes. So you got caught, but you still persisted on the path. That was the way that you seen it at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I got caught. Got caught multiple times after that as well too. Again, just multiple different arrests. No, the police busting the market and you getting caught and taken to the police station and stuff. It happened loads of times, to be honest. Yeah. And then it started to grind on me, if I'm being totally honest, after a while. I started questioning things when I was in my early 20s. I'd got a girlfriend then at that time, and my stepson, Shay, who's 26 now, he was 3. So I started questioning, like, where am I going here? What am I doing? Yeah. Like, what the fuck is actually going on? Where am I going to be in the next 5 years? Like, how do I want my life to kind of pan out? Yeah, so at that time, I was just starting to question things, like, why am I doing this?
Yeah. And I think you talk about there was one arrest that, or you've mentioned where you crashed the car.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in and around that time, I would have been, again, obviously in that job, but partying a bit. You know what I mean? I had
when,
a flat.
When you say partying, like, what does that look like?
So, partying would have been come the weekend, like, just letting loose, going out and drinking and taking drugs and going back to the. I had a flat in Gillia at the time, and it would have been just a session on there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it would have been
partying on there for a couple of days. And looking back now, you're like, fuck. No, those times were kind of crazy. Like,
yeah.
But when you're on it, then everybody else is doing it, and it was enjoyable at that time. You know, the things that you're doing, and it was just a bit of crack. You didn't. And we'll talk about that because the environment that you grew up in and around, and when everybody else is doing that type of thing, it's just normal. It just seems like everybody does it. That's what everybody does. So for me, it was the same. Just everybody was doing that type of thing in and around Gillia. My friends were all doing it. Everybody was partying. But that occasion, I think it was probably about 22 or 23, and I had been partying in the flat for a couple of days. Me and my wife, who is my girlfriend at the time, we'd finished, and we were finished for a while, and my head was kind of gone. And at the time, my mum was in hospital, and not to say that that's any reason or excuse at all, it wasn't. But I think I was probably feeling sorry for myself in some stage, or acting a victim, and I was like just going on the rampage, partying. But I've no real recollection of actually getting into the car and driving. But I remember obviously then when it, like, the impact. So I smashed my car head on the wall in the Brandywell in Derry. It was about 10:30 a Saturday morning. And then just commotion ensued from that. So I got out of the car, and there was a guy there that seen me, thought I was a joyrider. And rightly so, he smashed me and put me in my ass. And when I got up to try and explain and what was happening and stuff, it was pointless, do you know what I mean? So that just turned into a massive commotion. There was just, it seemed to be chaos there that morning, me being out of my mind, drunk and everything else. I tried to get away. Try to walk up along my road to get out of the road, but the cops came. Thankfully, now when I look back on it, because it was a turning point, cops came, arrested me, took me to the cell in the Strand Road. And I was that out of my mind. I don't think they took my bloods there and then. They put me in the cell. They, like, kind of, I don't know, sleep or sober up or something, because I remember them coming and getting me back out of the cell and then taking my bloods and then put me back in the cell again. And I must have fell asleep and woke up that night. They charged me and then they let me out. I went partying again that night. Went up the town, started partying again. So woke up in my flat then that morning, covered in blood, and asking myself questions like, what the fuck happened? And trying to kind of piece everything together of what went on. Again, that was over the last couple of days. No, we had been partying for those couple of days. And then that happened, and I just felt a real fucking low. Man, for a long while, what popped into my head was I could have killed somebody. No, there was a lot of Waynes that were going on to play football that morning, 10:30, and that was in my mind for a long while. And I remember my brothers then saying to me, like, fucking get yourself together, get yourself on, like, what are you doing? So at that time then I was like, right, I need to kind of sort this out, because it had kind of been just on that path for a couple of years. No, everything just felt like chaos. It was like as if I didn't give a shit. What was that type of feeling?
Like, why do you think that, you know, you allowed yourself to go that far to the point of, like, crashing into, well, potentially killing someone else and killing yourself before you actually says, I need to make the change?
Well, here's the thing, like, and this is stuff that I've learned and discovered the more I started to deep dive into human behavior and psychology, is that every single person lives by a unique set of priorities and a unique set of values, and they're fingerprint specific. And every single event in our life is trying to get us back to be ourselves. It's trying to get us back to be authentic, to live by our truest values. Health and fitness was always one of my highest values, always trained, always been involved in sport. Right up there, it was about 17, 18, stopped it. And then went on that crazy journey of, now don't get me wrong, I'm still training bits and pieces in between, but it wasn't where I am now or where I was before. And every single event is guiding us back to be who we're supposed to be, whether it's to that extreme or not. That time I didn't see it that way. Obviously with hindsight and introspection and doing a lot of work that I've done, I seen that event as it was something that had to happen. And most people will call that sabotage, but it's self-serving. Every mechanism is trying to get you back to be who you're supposed to be. So that event, as extreme as it was guiding me back to be who I'm supposed to be, to live in my highest values. Because after that event, once I started to kind of straighten myself out, what did I do? I got back into training again. I got back into health and fitness. I started bodybuilding. A year later, year and a half later, I competed. I won a local bodybuilding show, the Northern Ireland first timers category. That was in 2005. That gave me a platform to then become a personal trainer and start coaching. And from 2005 then onwards, that's what I've been doing. Actually living on my highest values and being who I was supposed to be. But all of those different paths and the things that I was getting up to and the things that I was doing wasn't me. So that event was a way to bring me back to do what I'm doing right now.
Yes. And when you say like, who I am or who I'm meant to be, and you know, your truest values, like what is that
for me? My highest values, and they kind of shift and change as you get older, and they can shift and change by certain circumstances, etc. But your values are intrinsic. Your highest values are intrinsic. They'll be the things that you're naturally inspired to go and do every single day, the spontaneous actions that you take when you feel most inspired, when you have most energy, where you're most organized, where you're most focused. That's you being yourself. That's your authentic self. Your authentic self is not exaggerating yourself and minimizing yourself. It's being in the middle and seeing both sides of yourself, the good, the bad, the ugly, the pain and the pleasure, the devil and the saint, let's say. That's you being in your highest values and being your most authentic. So at that time when I wasn't doing those things, when I was living outside of my highest values, that event happened to get me to fucking wake up. They bring me back in the, like, authenticity. So I humbled myself. That humbled me as well too. No, everything in every single event, every single circumstance in our life, you can view it in certain ways, but it's working for you a lot of the times to get you to wake up, to actually be yourself. So that event humbled me. I ended up in, as I said before we started, it wasn't all plain sailing after that. It wasn't as if things just started to click and all of a sudden, right, I'm now a coach and everything works out. I was in court for nearly another year after that for a different offense, where I actually thought it was going to, like, I was told I might get 3 months, 4 months, and I was fucking panicking.
What was that event?
That was over my former job and career. Like, it was, I got arrested, I was getting sued by Sony and PlayStation, and the cops had arrested me. I think I was getting done for, at that time, it was over £50,000 worth of counterfeit goods. So I was up and down the court Noma for a while. And I remember at that time going, if I get off of this, then that's it. I'm going to start to change. And that's when I started getting back into my training again. Started getting back into bodybuilding. Well, into bodybuilding kind of for the first time. Stopped drinking, stopped going out, partying, and things like that. That wasn't forever. But at that time, I went and watched the show with Big Dave Fox, who's a friend of mine. And I suppose was probably my first mentor. I never really knew what a mentor was, but he owned the gym in the Strand Road, Pro Gym, still does. And I remember going up to Belfast, up at the old Park Hotel in Belfast. I don't know if they do the show on there anymore now. But I remember looking at all the guys in the stage competing. I was like, fuck, I'd love to do that. No, I'd love to put my head down and do that. He says, put your head down for a year. He says, and you can do it. The following year I was on the stage, won that show. And then that gave me that platform. They start actually becoming a coach and a personal trainer. Started working in Dave's gym for a while. Loved it. Just loved being in the gym and, you know, seeing other people coming in and just the buzz and the environment. Because before that, I was, in between that time, I was dispatching. I was an adult then at this stage. I was 23, 24. And I was doing 12-hour shifts for £3 an hour dispatching. I had my now wife and a kid to kind of support. So again, it wasn't where I wanted to be, but I was fucking happy enough on there. I wasn't like doing stupid stuff, and I felt like I was on a path to improving, let's say.
You talk about the that of like that event was the event that kind of changed you. Do you know? So like, but you also say that everything is trying to change you, but it took that one to finally, you know, push you to make the change. And I think that's something that's so important, because sometimes people are, they have these they're being presented with these opportunities all the time, but they don't take that opportunity. They just keep going down that road. Why is that? Why are we like scared to change, even though it crosses our mind? It's like a behavior. They're like, nah, well, it'll be all right. I'll just keep going down this road. The road gets darker. Like,
yeah. Ultimately, because people perceive that there's more benefit in it than to do what they're doing, than there is benefit to changing. We only do anything when we perceive a benefit in it, and sometimes that's to the most extreme. So in the form of drink and alcoholism or drugs or addiction or whatever it might be, every addiction has a sub-addiction. So underneath that, there's something that person's moving away from, and the addiction is what they're moving towards. And unless the sub-addiction is actually really revolved and balanced out, then a lot of the time the addiction just keeps on happening. So change a lot of the times for people can be really, really challenging and tough, because they're perceiving more benefit in staying the same than they are in actually changing.
So they have this fear of that new change, and it's like the unknown.
Yeah, it's not necessarily the unknown, because we can only fear what we have in our mind. You know, we can't fear the unknown. We can only fear the content that we've had in our mind. So that comes from like past experiences, or what we've experienced growing up, or how we've been conditioned, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So for me, there's like, if you look at fear. There can be certainly be a fear to change, for sure. The fear to change a lot of the times can be because of maybe they tried it before and it didn't work out. Maybe they tried to change before and it didn't work out. And then there's a fear based around that. The pain of actually trying to change and go through that process and not working out is something that they maybe don't want to face again. But a lot of the times when it's to the extreme, in the form of addiction and just going down that path and not really wanting to change, it's because a lot of the times you haven't really resolved what's under the hood. The addiction is just a symptom. Mm-hmm. It's what's under the hood is needs to be resolved.
So when you talk about what's under the hood, is that like a resistance to accepting something that they don't want to accept, or?
For me, it's looking at things in a different way. So a lot of the work that I've done over the last 5 or 6 years, especially a lot of the work that I've studied under Dr. John DeMartini under human behavior, is when we have an imbalanced perception of how we think a thing was, then we've stored that subconsciously. We've viewed it as one way, which is a lot of the times negative, and we haven't actually seen how that event actually benefited us. So if we store all of our imbalanced perceptions subconsciously that are emotionally charged, then those events run us. We don't run them. So what we need to do is we need to dig a wee bit deeper and go back into those events and see how they benefited. Because every single thing has both sides. There's no event that happens that doesn't have a positive and negative. You can't separate them. You know, if you're searching for the positive, you automatically bring a negative with you because they're inseparable. But if we have a perception of something that happened to us and we see it as one side, what happens? We victimize ourselves. This happened to me, per me, woe me. And then what happens? That runs us. We're not in charge. We're not empowered because we've got that event subconsciously fucking running us ragged. But if we go back and look at that event and go, right, well, how did that actually serve me? How did that benefit me? How did it serve other people? How did it benefit other people? Would I have become the person that I am now if that event didn't happen? Because in hindsight, a lot of the things that we get, if we look at things that happen to us now and we get emotionally charged and all of a sudden we're angry and how could you do this and how could you say that? And I can't believe that they cut me out of my business or they did X, Y, and Z. And then 3 years' time, 5 years' time, 10 years' time, you look back and go, fuck, that was a blessing. I'm glad that happened. But wisdom is the instantaneous recognition that crisis is a blessing. So it's when you can see both sides simultaneously when it's happening. So you can balance out your perception of it. And that means that you're grateful for those events and you can find love and appreciation for those events. And then you free yourself from it.
So it sounds like a lot of people, they get caught up in the victim mindset.
100%.
And so I think there's sometimes a fear of change too with society. Oh, people might not accept me this way, you know, and that holds them back from stepping into that version. But there is gold when you step into that version. But like, how can you get people to actually focus on the, you know, which is called the survivor, and then you can become your own hero? Like, how can you get people to bring in that balance and make a decision that's allowing them to step into their power?
For me, the first step is actually identifying what their values actually are. I think most people have an idea of what they think values is. It's usually words like honesty and integrity and all these words. And there's nothing wrong with them, but they're not really human values. You'll see loads of companies and businesses with, like, their values are honesty and integrity and hard work and this, that, and the other. But then every single person, like, does something that's not honest, and they don't act with integrity all the time. Because we're human beings, and as human beings, we have our own intrinsic values, and our own intrinsic values are trying to be met every single time. So if a person doesn't know what they actually really value, I think that they do, but they're maybe not crystal clear on it. If a person doesn't really know what it is that they actually value, then it's hard for them to, like, map and plan their life out and structure their life and their days and their weeks and their months in and around what they find most inspiring. And what happens is, a lot of the times, is when you're not crystal clear on that, you try and live in somebody else's. And when you try and live in somebody else's, it's futile. You just can't do it. And that's when you start to minimize yourself. And that's when you start to sabotage yourself, so-called. And that's when you start to procrastinate and hesitate and frustrate. That's when you feel like you're not being yourself. You're trying to live by somebody else's set of priorities and set of values and minimizing yourself because of that. But when you understand your own, then you can actually be your authentic self, and then you can actually go after things that you really want. You can feel more inspired, more energetic. You'll have more focus, more energy in all of those areas. I'm not saying that once you figure that out, that it's all pleasure and no pain. You can't separate that either. You have to have both. But you're willing to pursue both pleasure and pain in its pursuit, because it's actually meaningful. So I would actually get a person to look at, this is a process that I take people through. It's a step-by-step questionnaire from, again, my mentor, Dr. DeMartini, and it helps you identify what your intrinsic values are. So you're not trying to live in accordance with society's values and who you think you should be. You understand what actually is meaningful to you. The Greeks called it the telos. It's your telos, which means the end goal in mind, the thing that you find most meaningful. They created a study around it called teleology. And that was to find out why people do what they do. Like, what is it that most people are looking for? We're all here for a reason. What is that? So for me, getting people to change ultimately, and I've worked with, like, loads of people on this, coaches, business owners, entrepreneurs, general people who are looking to lose weight, etc. If I can get them clear on what their real values actually are, it's like a switch sometimes. It's like, fuck. Because people beat themselves up all the time. They think that they procrastinate. They think that they sabotage. But for me, those things are self-serving mechanisms, because you're trying to go after something that you actually don't really value, and those things are trying to bring you back again.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Of course it does. And then why are people then somewhat conditioned or following other values that maybe aren't true to themselves?
Society pressures, because from a young age, we are taught that this is what you should do and this is who you should become. And, like, society through teachers, preachers, parents, schools, the system as a whole, I feel, kind of conditions you into thinking that this is who you should become, and this is who you should be, and this is what's important for you. But I ultimately still believe that most people are fulfilling what it is that they find most meaningful at all times anyway. So your values are shaped from your voids. So the voids that you experience are the thing that drives your value. So if you've got a big void, you can guarantee it's linked to your highest value. So it's a matter of looking at what the void was maybe in childhood or your upbringing, or maybe what the void is right now. So to give you an example, if I am in business and I experience a lack of cash and income, and there's a lack of leads and sales, I've got a void. What am I going to do? Well, I'm going to value more leads and sales and marketing and trying to bring in more money. So those things can happen from a deeper emotional aspect. Let's say in your upbringing that you didn't experience love or connection. And as a coach or as an entrepreneur or as the thing that you're doing, you experience love and connection. I did this exercise at one of my talks, and a girl made that connection for the first time. I got her to write out her voids, biggest to smallest. And then I got her to see what it is that she does every single day. One of the big voids that she had was love and connection. and she's a carer. So she goes into homes and cares for people. Mm. And she says, I'd never seen that before. She says, that's where I get love and connection. So the highest void that you have, or the biggest void that you have, is going to drive the thing that you find most meaningful.
Mm-hmm. How do people know? Like, how do you make people aware of this? Like, because a lot of the time people don't even know that they're conditioned by society. They're just in this, I suppose, robotic mode.
I think for me, man, it's really a path of your own kind of self-discovery. Like, it's wanting to know. For me, I think from such a young age, I've always wanted to know a wee bit more. You know, I've always been searching for something. You know, I've always felt like I was searching for something. I didn't really know what it was. And it's been in many different forms. Knowledge and experience and connection, and I've always wanted to know more about myself. I've always wanted to know more about who we are and why we're here and the cosmos and what's going on and what the fuck are we doing on this spinning ball? What's it all about? So that's always led me down a path of just studying and trying to find out more. And then certain events and things that happened in my life have also directed me towards that as well too. I think for people they really want to change, they have to really like actually want to change. They have to really want to discover more about themselves. Most people are, again, fulfilling what they find is most meaningful, whether that's in a job or a career, whether that's as a mom or a father, a teacher, a preacher, whatever it might be. Whatever they're finding most meaning in, and whatever they feel is giving them more benefits over negatives, more advantages over disadvantages, they're going to keep doing that no matter what. Could they do it to a better level? Could they be more of themselves and expand more in their lives? Yeah, 100%. But every single person, as I said, has a unique set of priorities and values. And if we try and think that this person should be us, or why are you not doing that? It's a futile attempt. There's going to be a conflict. But if a person can organize their life around what they find most meaningful and most value and expand on that, then happy days, they're living their own path. So I think a lot of the times, and I've made that mistake before as a coach, thinking that they should be doing X, Y, and Z, but they're always going to do what's most important to them. And that could be in any way or form.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned, like, you know, everyone has like a unique fingerprint or blueprint.
Yeah, so everybody, like the values, everybody has a unique set of priorities and values. Yeah, no two are the same. Every single person is unique in that way. So for an example, if I was trying to get my wife to do the things that I do, they like the things that I like, they read the things that I read, they love how I love, you can guarantee there's an argument there. There's conflict automatically.
Yes.
And if she tried to get me to do the things that she does and the things that she loves and the things that she likes, there's not a fucking chance. It's not going to happen. But if we understand each other, then there's communication and we can move towards and help each other grow. But when we don't understand each other, then that's when the conflict occurs. Why is she not fucking doing that? Why is he not doing that?
Yeah.
That's when conflict occurs. So, but when we understand what's most meaningful and most important is, I'll give you a prime example, and it just happened again, like literally 2 weeks ago. I was showing my wife, Emma, it was a podcast I was listening to, and I wanted her to listen to it, and she didn't want to listen to it because she doesn't really appreciate it. It's not something she's inspired by. And I was trying to get her to listen to it, and then there was why are you not listening? I just want you to listen to it, just to hear it. And then I just caught myself. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? And she says that to me. She says, look, I don't mind supporting you and your values and helping you grow and doing that, but I'm not going to live on yours and I'm not going to do those things. This is what you preach.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a friendly reminder. We're always getting reminded that trying to get people to be us is just stupid.
Yeah, we can get caught up in that too. And it's like, even though I'm doing this podcast, I can't put expectations on the people around me to listen, because they might not want to listen to me, you know.
Exactly.
And I think there is an element of when people, we want other people to like and do the things that we do. But I think, like, at the core of the human being, that we do have like key values that are really important, like love and understanding and acceptance. But sometimes they get thrown out by society, like, you know, acceptance being one, and love, and this is like, they're all distorted. You know, like, how can we overcome them challenges as a community? Like, what steps do we need to take?
What I've found, and this is something that I've said time and time again, probably the best definition of what I've heard of love is. Love is a synchronicity of complementary opposites, which means it's the opposite pairs. It's not the fluffy thing that you see in TV and, you know, it should be all flowers and roses and all of that sort of stuff. Most people have that feeling of what love is. But love is a complementary, it's the synchronicities of complementary opposites. So it's, again, it comes back kind of down to values again, where we complement each other. You know, if I'm expecting a person to be a certain way, and then all of a sudden they don't live up to my expectations, and now I don't love them, well, is that love? Is that true love? True love is accepting both sides of that person, seeing the good and the bad in them, like the evil and the hero and the villain. It's accepting both sides of nature, it's accepting both sides of the world. I think we get caught up in the illusion, expecting a one-sided fantasy. Mm-hmm. And then when it doesn't happen, we kick ourselves, we blame other people, and we go, like, why? But that's just never, ever going to happen. No, you can't have a one-sided anything. And the fantasy is that it's all pleasure, no pain, all happiness, no sadness. No, that life's supposed to be this just blissful experience. And it can be if we accept that there's two sides to it.
Yeah. So I'm with you on that, you know. What is it that can make life blissful? So I know you mentioned the accepting both sides, but because a lot of people are like, life is always happening to me instead of for me. Mm. Like, what is the change there?
Well, the change is your perception. It's how you view it.
So you're saying it's a choice?
Yeah.
You choose to see it this way, the negative or the positive?
Yeah, 100%. Or it's not to view it, and well, you can turn a negative into a positive, or you can balance out that equation. Instead of trying to turn a negative into a positive, you can see how that negative actually benefited you. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing both sides of it. So if we're constantly expecting it to just be a positive, what you're actually doing is you're attracting the negative to bring you back into balance. So if you imagine that that's a pole of energy, that's a positive and that's a negative. Anytime that I seek a one-sided anything with trying to push to be this person, trying to live in this illusion a lot of the times, trying to be this happy, blissful person, positive all the time, and you know deep down inside that's not who you are all the time. You're both-sided. Mm-hmm. So if you keep pushing for that,
yeah,
what do? You attract the negative again. You can't separate the two. One comes with it. So you attract the negative circumstances or the negative person or somebody comes along and brings you off your pedestal and brings you back into balance again. Now all of a sudden you're like, oh, fuck, that negative person's trying to ruin my buzz. I want to be this positive only person.
Mm-hmm.
That person's actually there to bring you back into balance again and show you homeostasis. Like, yes. We always want, we're never ever going to be in equal balance. But our brain and our physiology and our psychology is always looking for homeostasis. So when we're out of balance, things happen, they bring us back around again. So from trying to be this positive person, which I've done loads of times, try to be this one-sided person, realized that it was a stupid attempt, it wasn't going to happen, and I started to accept both sides of my nature. I started to accept that sometimes I'm happy and I'm positive, and sometimes I'm fucking angry and annoyed, and if you support me in the things that I like really value, I'm usually a wee bit more like happier. If you challenge me in the things that I value, then you're going to see a different side. And every single person is that way. If they would accept both sides of their nature, I think that people could feel more whole and authentic with themselves, that they're not trying to live in this facade, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes. Are you aware of the like seven laws of the universe, the Kabbalion?
Yeah.
They talk about the law of polarity.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a positive and a negative and
up and a down and in and out. Yeah.
And you are right. It's like we... It's
law of contrast, same thing.
Yeah. So it... We think, being positive, but it's actually positive and negative, or they can both be positives or both be negatives. It's like living along the middle.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot, and that's like a law that exists above
it's
a us.
Universal law. It can't be broke. So there's another one as well called the law of heuristic escalation, which is order and disorder. Whenever order is imposed, disorder is created. They bring mm-hmm. balance. Whenever there's disorder, order is imposed. They bring balance. When there's a war going on, there's a rally for peace. Mm-hmm. These things are happening all the time.
Yeah.
And this is always going on.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes in our delusions, we think that we can change it.
Yeah.
But it's happening.
And then that's like the law of rhythm, which swings to the left, must swing to the right. So as happy as you can be, you're going to feel sadness on the exact same level.
100%.
So it's bringing it into the
and
middle
of
the
time. And it's happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
Your brain's doing it. Whenever you big yourself up, you automatically, if you're being conscious, you'll see that you're bringing yourself down at the same mm-hmm. time. you'll become aware of, right, well, if I start to act cocky and big myself up, if you don't bring yourself down, somebody else will.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody will give you a comment, or somebody will come along and bring you back down again off your pedestal.
Yeah.
And that's naturally happening. When you're in a pit and you're beating yourself up, what happens? Somebody comes along and they bring you back up again.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
always going on.
And then you say, like, someone will bring you down. So, like, does that person bring you down, or is that, are you allowing them to bring you down?
Well, you're allowing them, they bring you down, because nobody can impact your feelings and emotions other than you. It's your perception of it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? So I'm not saying that that is something then that you just go, oh, well, nobody can impact me, because we're human beings and we still get triggered and we still have those challenges and all of those things happen. But I think when we become that wee bit more aware and conscious, and we can start to balance ourselves out, we can see those things, and instead of like blaming people and labeling people and calling them that, I did a video on that, which was, what do you do? And I labeled the title something that I knew people would kind of catch on to, but it wasn't what I wanted to talk about. It was like, what do you do with a toxic person? And basically what I was saying was instead of actually labeling that person as toxic, and that person is constantly trying to bring you down, and maybe they're constantly saying these things or doing these things, identify where you do that as well. Like, where do you perform the same trait? Where do you perform the same action? When have you done the exact same thing? They're the same quality and the same quantity as that person. And then basically what you're doing is you're kind of owning your own shit as well, and you're balancing out your judgment of that person, which a lot of the times we do.
You mentioned judgment. Why do we judge?
We do it all the time. Every single person does it. I think it's judging ourselves and judging other people is, I suppose, it's maybe something that's inherent on us from like how we evolved, for us to be able to actually live in the world and judge certain things that's happening in the world, judging ourselves in certain situations, etc., trying to fit in, trying to conform. Are we going to be accepted? Are we not going to be accepted? Are we going to be ostracized? All these different things. So we judge our actions, we judge other people. I think it's probably a deeper survival mechanism that's there. And I think also too, it's a balancing act in our brain. Like, our psychology is looking for it. We're trying to judge certain things. We judge ourselves, and we're a lot of the times trying to bring ourselves back into balance.
Mm.
We can judge people unfairly, of course, 100%. And part of what I coach people on is to be less judgmental of themselves and of other people. And they see that every single thing plays a part. Every single event has played a part in your life. They actually empower you or disempower you, depending on how you want to look at it.
Yeah. So then, is there like a healthy way to judge? Is there a healthy judgment?
I suppose there is a healthy way to judge. Well, a healthy way to judge would be, again, to like see both sides of the equation. I suppose it would be unwise to judge yourself unfairly. We do that a lot of times. We judge ourselves, we beat ourselves up, we put ourselves down because we think that we've done something wrong. A lot of the times we live up to like these expectations that have been put on us by society, through religions, through, again, like government, preachers, teachers, all these different things. Like, I mean, we don't fit into that model, and we can't be this pristine person, let's say, in society's eyes, then we judge ourselves unfairly for it. And a lot of the things, a lot of the times that these things that we're supposed to live by, these values, they're just moral hypocrisies.
Mm.
No fucking person actually really lives by them. Again, they live by their own set of values and their own priorities. So if we're judging ourselves based on somebody else, a lot of the times it's, again, we're not seeing both sides of it. So a lot of the times if I put you in a pedestal and I like see you as a certain person and I view you as more successful than me, more wealthy than me, more like healthier and fitter than me, then what do? I judge myself and put myself in a pit and I minimize myself. But I'm unconscious of what's in you I actually have in me as well. So I'm not seeing the other side as well. I'm not seeing what you have in me I also have, but I'm displaying it in my values and the things that's most important to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm judging myself unfairly because I'm seeing one side of you when there's two sides of you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So we do this a lot of the times.
There's like, it's just part of human nature, you know, we go through that process, but like We do it subconsciously. I think we see something or we hear something or we see somebody doing something or maybe even wearing something or this hairstyle, and like you're triggered and you judge them without actually realizing that you've just judged them, you know. And that was a process for me, you know. It's just like I had to catch the trigger and I caught it. I was like, ah. And then in that moment, then I would go celebrate that person. It is fucking amazing that they are unique and in their own way, you know, and that's the other side. And it brings in like joy and love to that moment, you know.
You wouldn't get triggered if you didn't have it within yourself.
Everything
that you judge on another person, you have within yourself.
Yeah.
There's like something that there's 4,500 like different human traits, and every single person has them, but we display them in different areas. We usually display them in areas that, again, we value more, but we all have those traits. And if you were to be totally honest with yourself and you judge that person and ask, right, well, what is it that you're judging them? What's the action? What's the inaction? What's the thing that they're doing? Well, where do I do that? Mm-hmm. Where have I done that? Maybe the same person. For what I'm judging them, I've also got within myself.
Yeah.
And it minimizes the judgment and the emotional charge, and it brings you back into balance, basically.
Yeah. So then, is that a case of the reason that you're judging is because you're still judging yourself, which means there's a lack of love in that place in you? So you're not loving yourself? Yeah. Like,
so it's a void within yourself that you've not become aware of. So it's like if you put somebody else on a pedestal and you see something in them, you're conscious of their upsides and you're unconscious of their downsides. And at the same time, when you minimize yourself, you're conscious of your downsides and unconscious of your upsides. Mm-hmm. So it's an unbalanced view. So whatever thing that you've judged in them, go and find it within yourself.
Yeah.
Go and see where you have it. Go and see where you display it. See where you actually represent and do the exact same thing to the same degree, but it's going to be in your values. It's going to be in the area that you prioritize and value most. So it could be as a mum. I'll give you an example. I had a client and she said that she was completely unorganized. She was always distracted and she just couldn't get things together and her head was all over the place. And she's just, I just can't seem to get any focus or organization. I says, right, okay. I says, run me through your day. Like, what do you do when you get up? She says, I get up early in the morning, get the kids ready, get the breakfast and stuff ready. Have their packed lunches and stuff done. The school bags are all ready. She says, and I've got everybody kind of ready to hit the door and get ready for school, get them in the car. And I take them to school and then I come back and I kind of do the house and I get the cleaning and stuff done and do everything else. And then I go and lift them again from school and blah, blah, blah. I went through this whole, that sounds pretty organized to me. I says, who are you expecting to be? Or who are you trying to be? And who are you comparing yourself to? You're organized in the areas that you prioritize and value most. And you're disorganized in the areas that you don't. But if you're trying to be somebody else and thinking that you should be a different person, you're going to feel disorganized. But if you look closely at what you prioritize and value most, you can see that you're already organized. Mm-hmm. Doing all those things every single day is organization.
Yeah.
But so if we're trying to be somebody else, then we're going to beat ourselves up.
Yeah. So is that a case of thinking that they should be someone else or comparing them to someone else? Yeah, or
both.
Yeah.
Thinking that they should be somebody else instead of honoring themselves and living by their own unique set of values and the things that they actually prioritize most.
So then there's this, that's the trap of comparison where we're, but comparison is the thief of joy. They say we're happy and then we look at someone else and like, oh,
why don't I have that?
Yeah.
Where's my, like, and it's usually a lot of the times on superficial stuff and we see somebody with something or we see somebody with a certain aspect of like wealth or money or something like that. And a good question to ask is, right, well, where's my wealth? Mm-hmm. It's there.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It might be in your children. It might be in your loving relationship. It might be in travel. It might be in something else that you would never exchange for that thing that you think is wealthy. So if you actually ask yourself better questions and go, right, well, where is my wealth? It's here, but it's in a different form. People think that it should be in like digits in the bank, or it should be cash in hand, or it should be this, that, and the other. There's many different forms of wealth. There's financial wealth, of course, but a lot of the times that's what we compare things to. But again, if financial wealth isn't high in your values, then it's not really going to be there. It'll be in a different form, though. Mm-hmm. It could be in your family.
Yeah. So they say abundance is already there. You know, like, how do people tap in to whatever their abundance is? Is it a case of accepting it that it's there? Or because a lot of people say, oh, when I get there, you know? Yeah. So it's like you're
assuming that you're already not good enough and you don't have it. Yeah.
Like, how do you bring it to the moment? Because the only moment that's real is the present moment.
Yeah. For me, abundance again is kind of looking at where you're already blessed, looking at your life and knowing that there's certain areas of your life that you're abundant in. Again, it'll be linked to the things that you prioritize most. It's going to be in your highest values. It could be your abundant love, your abundant health and fitness and freedom to go and be who you want to be, do the things that you want to do. I think if we get trapped in constantly searching and looking, and I've done this many a time and still do it as an entrepreneur and a business owner and a coach, you're always kind of looking for that next level. You're trying to move forward and grow constantly. And then you kind of catch yourself and go, right, well, if I look at everything that I have here right now, would I change it? Like, am I not already abundant? You have everything that you need at that time. But if we're constantly searching outside of ourselves for something, then are we ever really going to find it? Because it's a feeling that you think that you're going to get. And that feeling's already inside you.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're constantly putting it on the end of the month, or it's going to be next year, or maybe I'm going to get it when I retire, it's a trap of that. There's actually a book called The Happiness Trap. And there was a podcast I did with a guy who was a former mentor of mine, Chris Evans. And this will bring that into perspective brilliantly. And he talked about the illusion of the finish line. So he had created multiple 8-figure, 9-figure companies. And he woke up one morning and he's like, is this it? He felt trapped. He felt completely closed in. He felt trapped. He felt disillusioned, unhappy, depressed, anxious, all these different things. And he's like, no, it's just like, it's next month. No, then that feeling's going to come. When it's the next best month, or it's the next business that we create, or it's the next thing that we do, then I'm going to get that feeling that I'm searching for. It never fucking arrived.
Mm.
And it never does.
No,
and because we're constantly searching for that thing that's unattainable.
Yeah.
We think that if we get to this like certain period or certain time, what we've done ultimately is we've exchanged the challenges that we have now for a different set of challenges. That's all we've done. So we've maybe moved up the ladder, but we've now got a new set of challenges. We've now got a new set of pains and pleasures. We've now got a new set of growth and support and growth and challenges. All the things come together. They're just at a different level. I think the delusion is that when we get to a certain place, it's again going to be that fantasy where it's all happy, everything's abundant, everything's peaceful, and everything's the way it should be. And it's a disillusion. We've just swapped the set of challenges that we have currently for a different set.
Yeah. So it sounds like what you're saying, there is no destination. It's a journey, and yeah, it's a never ending journey. Mm. And to appreciate where you're at right now in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, instead of the when I get there.
Yeah.
This day, that day.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. What about yourself? Like, I'm sure there's many times that you've set goals, things that you wanted to do, wanted to achieve, and you thought, right, well, it's just going to be there. And then you get there and you go, is that it?
Mm. Definitely. Is that it? Yeah, I spoke about it too. I had a business in my 20s and all this, and I had these goals. And all. When I got there, I was like, what? Why am I not happy?
Mm.
And I was like, do you know what? It actually made me question reality.
Mm.
And that just sent me in a whole different direction. And what I learned from that experience of business and money and all that jazz was that it was taking me further away from who I was. But the further I went away, I got to turn and come back inward. Mm. And I then got to experience, actually, this is who I am. And actually, I'm good enough as I am in this moment. And nothing really, like, yes, we need money to survive and all that there, but like, it's never going to bring you happiness. You have to be happy with who you are in the moment. And then I was like, I'm happy with who I am eventually, after a few years of doing all that.
And then create from that space.
Yeah. And that's what's led to this, you know, now it's just like, I'm doing something that I actually want to help people, you know, because so many people are caught up in that illusion, you know, of like when I get there, you know.
Yeah.
It's just like we're already here.
Exactly.
We are where we're meant to be.
Exactly. You know? It's not going to be a destination line that you cross over and go, oh, fuck, right, everything's just brilliant here now.
Yeah.
It's just again the same set of pleasures and pains and supports and challenges.
Yeah. And then I think time has created that illusion, because there's a start and an end. So we think there's a, you know, so that, and that's where we think we get caught up in that then, you know. So it's like, that's why the present moment is the only real moment. And I feel like everything is happening at once, you know.
And if you constantly try and bring yourself back to that moment each time and go, right, well, like, most of our anxieties are based on future fears and anxieties or past experiences, like, again, kind of happening. We talk about fears and all those different things. So when you bring yourself back to that present moment, and you can see that, well, I've got everything that I need right now. I'm okay. I'm breathing. I'm healthy. I'm doing the things that I want to do. Like, can you improve? Of course, 100%. And I really truly believe that you should, in accordance with what's for you. Do you know what I mean? But when we boil it right down, we're not very rarely are we in that immediate danger. We're not getting attacked by a fucking saber-toothed tiger or a lion or any of those things. Most of us are able to put our hand in food and do all those things. Like, we've got that. We've got our basic needs met for the vast majority of the time, for the vast amount of people. Not everybody's the same, 100%. But yeah, we get just caught up. We get caught up and trapped, I think, a lot of the times, chasing something that a lot of the times when we get there, we really realize it wasn't that important.
Mm-hmm. And then that's like the beauty of life. You get to experience that, like the polarity, the whole swing to the left to get the whole swing to the right. And then it's like, I feel like we're constantly swinging, but less and less, you know, and it's always coming into that balance, you know. And I'm not to get to that balance, I definitely can't say that I'm there, but it's like, it's learning to swing a little less, a little right. And then when you kind of understand that there's no good or bad, it just is, you know.
And then your addiction to balance is what's going to put you out of balance.
Yeah. Oh, it's a hard act.
Yeah. Because again, you're attracting something else to bring you back again. So we all want to be neutral, I suppose, in our mind and like on how we view things, so we're not getting the swings of polarity. Like, nobody wants that, the ups and the downs and like bipolar, basically. Nobody really wants that. You do want to be neutral. You want to kind of see like both sides of what's going on so you can appreciate things. Doesn't mean that you're not going to be fucking challenged and go through some difficult times and all of that, of course. But
what's your view on like the labels, so say like being called bipolar? If someone identifies with that word, then how is that healthy for them, or is that a good way to label themselves?
To be honest, I'm against like what most of the labels are put on people. I actually wrote a post on attention deficit. I put a video up today on it, attention deficit disorder, and I'm going to post that in my socials this evening, which was, if I look back, if I was at school now, I'd be labeled as attention deficit disorder. I'd have ADD. Most of my reports said, can't pay attention, easily distracted, doesn't focus, doesn't do this, doesn't do that. Fucking definition of ADD. But that's not what it was. No. Like, you'll have attention surplus in the areas that you actually really love and that you're focused on, that you're inspired by. You'll have attention surplus in those areas. You have attention deficit by default in the areas that you don't, because they're not high in your values. You retain information and you have retention surplus in the areas that you truly value and that you're inspired by and you want to learn. And you have retention deficit in areas that you don't. Your brain is doing that. It's having to do that. We filter information in and out of our brain according to what we value most. And if we didn't, it would be a mind fuck. Mm-hmm. Taking in all of that information all the time, you just couldn't survive. So your brain is actually doing that. It's a homeostatic mechanism. They try and keep you in check and keep you in balance. So attention deficit disorder, a lot of the times, I would have been labeled that for sure in school, but it wasn't ADD. Mm-hmm. I just didn't like school. There was nothing there that inspired me. I didn't want to learn anything. I knew that I wasn't going to go on and become a joiner or like speak Spanish or Gaelic or do any of those things. Like, there was nothing there that I actually really wanted to apply myself to. I enjoyed PE because it was about a sport. But other than that, I didn't find how school was serving me. So of course I had attention deficit. Of course I was out the window dreaming, fucking going and playing football. Mm-hmm. My brain was actually trying to do those things to keep me in check. So, but if I look and go, right, well, where do I have attention surplus right now? And I had a conversation with a client last week who thought I had it as well. I says, where are you focused on my work? Where are you focused on my finances? Where are you focused on my business? You're focused in the areas that you value. were he unfocused on the areas that he doesn't value? But if we label ourselves and we're trying to be somebody that we're not supposed to be, then we say, oh, we've got attention deficit, or we've got this, that, and the other, and we start to label ourselves. I believe that, for me anyway, I believe that labels are just attached to people so too often and too fast, and people are going and then maybe getting medication for certain things instead of understanding themselves and what they actually really truly are inspired to do and become, and stop trying to get people to fit into boxes that they shouldn't actually be in, especially the school system. The school system for me is, you need to learn this, you need to learn that, you need to do this, you need to do that. Why? Why do I need to learn that information? Why do I need to know about the Battle of Hastings in 1066? Some of the stuff is just obsolete, and it's outdated, and it needs to be really, really brought up to speed. Like what I learned in school as an entrepreneur, I didn't learn anything about like taxes, I didn't learn anything about like how to set up business properly, I didn't learn any of those things that I actually do right now. So for me, I think the school system tries to get people to fit in their model and their box. I mean, don't fit in that box, there's something wrong with me.
So it's like, if you don't fit the system, this is the label you're getting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now there's something wrong with me.
Yeah.
Which isn't true.
Just because you didn't have an interest in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then sometimes these people, these kids who get these labels, grow up into adults, and then they accept it, or they take this belief on because they've been programmed from a young age. Like, how can they let go of that program that they have wrote, you know, their brain is wired that way?
Instead of even getting to there, like, and I went through this with a client when she talked about her son. And I asked, where is he focused? Where does he have attention? Where would he sit all day long and not move around? Where does he actually like want to learn, and where does he want to be? And she was able to identify it. I says, well, he's doing what's most important for him. He's learning and he's focused and he's got energy and he's inspired to do the thing that's most important for him. But if we try to get him, or you try to get him to fit into this model that's not that inspiring, or not what he actually truly values, then of course there's going to be conflict, and of course there's going to be certain aspects of not paying attention and not being focused, and because he doesn't want to do it. Like, we all know that from school. Like, like, unless a person really loves school and what they're studying, they'll come home and do their homework. Try to get me to come home and do my homework. It was an absolute nightmare. I'm not sure. I've maybe done it a couple of times, but there wasn't a chance. I wanted to come home, throw a bag in the school, forget all about it, go out and play football. That's what I wanted to do. Now, there's a linking exercise that you can do. You can link lower values to higher values. And it's a process that gets you to find the benefit in doing X because it'll benefit this. So I'll give you an example for me as a coach. Let's say it's weight loss. So if I have a client who says that they want to lose weight, but they're not losing weight, even though they're constantly saying that they want to do it, it's not happening, they're still not losing weight. Well, it's not that valuable for them. It's not really, really high in their priorities. Even though they know that it's going to be a massive benefit to be fitter, stronger, and healthier, other things are more priority. So if other things are more priority, then their actions is going to be revolved in and around that. But if I get them to start linking the benefits of you being a fitter, stronger, healthier person, let's say their family is their number one priority, well, how would it benefit your family if you're now fitter, stronger, and healthier? And start to list those benefits and start to link them, like 20, 30, 40, 50. And when you start to link the benefits and you start to see that, then all of a sudden you're starting to make the connection. It has more meaning for you. You're starting to change your behaviors according to it. You can get the emotional connection there. And then over time, neuroplastically, your brain begins to shift and change then as well too because of that. Because you're literally de-pruning old pathways and you're laying down new pathways, and you're starting to actually move towards a different version of yourself. But there's certain linking exercises you can do around that. So if you can do that exactly the same thing with a kid that has not paying attention in certain areas, but is focused in this area, we'll start to link the benefits of doing this to the thing that he actually really wants to do. And it might start to change.
So then you touched on two things there. Just with the kids, the kids definitely have an interest in something. And then when they don't fit the system, then they're labeled with something. And then you also mentioned where someone has their values with weight loss, and then you are labeled to link the higher and the lower. But what is it about, if that person is this, like if that person or that parent was to spend more time, like set aside time for themselves. Maybe that they're not, maybe their whole time is in the family, but they give time to themselves. How, is that a case of devaluing family time or valuing themselves, or what kind of impact can that have?
So say it again, sorry.
So if someone, you know, decides, no, I can't take that hour, or I can't take them 2 hours out because I need to be with my family. You know, maybe they work Monday to Friday, yeah, and then they're like, oh, they don't give themselves any time.
Okay.
All their time is family.
Hmm.
But they also feel like
they want to train.
Yeah. And, yeah. But they have a guilt.
Mm.
It, like, should they feel guilty or no, should they give themselves time?
No, guilt is the assumption that you've caused more negatives than positives in any situation. And there can't be. There has to be two. So definitely you don't feel guilty over it because, again, you're doing what's most important for you. And if family is number one, then you're going to go towards that, most importantly. And you're going to, again, do the things that you perceive more benefit in. So if there's more benefit in staying home and actually being with the family than there is to go into the gym, that person's going to do that.
Yeah.
So if they do want to change, then they go through the Lincoln exercise. And then what they need to do is they need to structure their day and go, right, well, when is the time that I can actually get to the gym and train without it impacting my family? When's the time that I can get to the gym and train and still get to spend time with my family? So if I go and train early morning and then go to work and then I come home and it's family time, there's no interruption there because 9 times out of 10, if you're training early in the morning, family's probably sleeping. If they're away to school and you're away to work, you should separate it at that time anyway. Come home that night, spend time with family. So it's about linking the thing first so that you can get the behavior shift and actually see the benefit and actually doing it. And then structuring your days around that and going, right, well, I'm going to train at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. or whatever time might work for you that doesn't disrupt the time that you want to spend with your family.
Yeah.
And then your values might shift. Health and fitness might then become that wee bit higher. Family might come down a wee bit. And that's okay as well. Because now you're starting to put more emphasis and value on your health and fitness because you see the importance in it. So the other things might have to move down the scale a bit. And they do. They fluctuate up and down every few months anyway.
And then what about, like, say, parents who don't have that time during the week, but they have it at the weekend, but then they feel guilty because they feel... Is, like, I'm always under the impression that if you do take that time for yourself, that showing up for yourself then has a positive impact, you know, or a well-being impact on the people around you. Because a lot of, I'm aware of people who are like, oh, I feel guilty if I take that time. But maybe that time will actually benefit them in that space that they can then, their kids can reap. Is that, what's your view on that?
You'll always find time for the things that you prioritize most. You'll always find time for the things that you value most. I hear it time and time again.
Yeah.
I've been coaching people for in health and fitness in the gym for nearly 20 years. I don't have the time.
Mm-hmm.
No, you do. You're just not prioritizing it. It's not important enough for you. You do have the time. Like,
you
can get up at 5 in the morning, get up at 6 in the morning. I had a girl who was in my coaching program for a couple of years. She was at a seminar of mine in 2019 at the City Hotel. She's a good friend of mine now. She's a good friend anyway. I knew her for years. But she was the same. She says, I don't have the time to train. Like, I just don't have the time. I've got the kids and all to get out in school in the morning. And I just says, bullshit. As you do, you get up at 5 o'clock, you get up at 6 o'clock. And that's what she started doing after that seminar. She got up, started running, exercising, doing it first thing in the morning and getting it done. And then going home and getting the kids out for school and stuff like that. So if we prioritize it enough and we value it enough, we'll always find the time for it. It's the same with money.
Yeah.
No, I don't have the money to join the gym and hire a coach. But you'll go out every single weekend and spend it on X, Y, and Z. You do have the money, you just don't value this enough to actually allocate the money towards it.
Yeah.
But you can, again, shift that. You can change that. And that's not the, like, it's not the judge anybody at all on any of those things because, as I said, people are always going to do what's most important to them and move towards what they find most priority in. But if you're constantly saying that you want to do X, Y, and Z, then a simple way is they link the thing that you want to do to the thing that you're actually doing most and the thing that you love most.
Mm-hmm.
So you find more meaning in it.
Yeah.
And then sometimes there's just unconscious motives that stop people from doing it. So a person might say that they want to lose weight and they've been saying it for years and years and years, but there's an unconscious motive there stopping them.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe they have had a weight loss journey before and they lost a lot of weight and it was tough and it was challenging and they rebounded that weight back on again and it felt embarrassing. So now they've associated that weight loss with pain and something that's a struggle and something that's hard, and to go through that again might not be something that they want to do. So there's an unconscious motive there to keep the weight on.
Mm-hmm.
It could be something completely different. There's a lot of the same stuff there that can be balanced out and resolved.
Yes. you're a very skilled coach, you know, from what I know, even just talking to you there. And that's not just the only thing that you offer, you know. You tell me a bit more about the other tools that you have that you can help people with.
For me, it's just, as I said, as a coach, I've just always been exploring different things. Especially in the health and fitness game and the fitness like space. For me, I was always looking at, well, why does one person get a result, and like, why is another person not getting a result? And it was never the training and the nutrition and those types of things. That was never that. So for me, it was always got to do with like what's going on in the mind. I started studying hypnosis, and then I went through, became a breathwork facilitator as well too with Soma. Are you familiar with Soma?
No, tell me more.
Naraj Nick. Did that through lockdown, so became a facilitator in breathwork as well too, which is another like fantastic tool.
Like, can you give me like a bit more depth into the technique and what it can do?
Well, what it can do, again, I suppose ultimately is balancing out your physiology and your psychology. It's like you're obviously going to improve your health and everything else is along with that, but breathwork can be used for emotional release, for like resolving certain traumas, etc. I had a girl that came to me a few years ago who was suicidal, and it was a friend of mine brought her down, and I started doing some work with her, and she was with me then for a few months and progressing fantastically. When she came in, she was just like a shell of who she was and a shell of who I actually seen her become. And what I noticed within her straight away, and you'll notice that with anybody that's depressed or like really anxious and feeling that way, is they actually don't breathe properly. You can tell a lot about a person by how they actually breathe. So she was breathing high in the chest, shallow in the chest. At the start, we kind of struggled to actually get her to breathe and use her diaphragm properly because of the tension and depression and how she was feeling. But she overcame that, and she kept coming down, and she was consistent with it. And I got her to do different things as well too, and listen to certain things. Cut a long story short, it's probably about 6 months in the time that I'd first met her, and she'd sent me a message. She sent me a WhatsApp message, and she said, last week was the date that I'd planned to take my life. And I was like, well, look at you now. And she says, yeah, thank you. And she obviously had resolved a lot of her issues, and she had overcome the things that she was experiencing, and she'd been like that for a long time. So breathwork is a tool like that. They release emotion and release certain traumas and balance out your mind and balance out certain things. It can be a fantastic, fantastic tool. So it can be used. I do it every single day. I do it every single evening.
So like I've been involved in breathwork, you know, a few multiple times, and I've been in a class, and there's probably been the guts of like 70 or 80 of us in it, up to one time, you know, with these facilitators in this community that I'm part of. But there was one time, there was half the class was erupted in tears, and then everyone was crying. So like whatever the breathwork was doing, you know, the tool of deep breathing and the, you know, with the breath and all.
We've got the emotional.
What was it like? Is it opening up our body, or
you've got the emotional body? Like the, I always loved Dr. Joe Dispenza. He says that the body is the unconscious mind. So we, like a lot of the times, we just get up and do the same thing over and over and over again. We repeat the same processes over and over and over again. And emotionally, we store stuff in the body. Like the back has been always linked to feeling under pressure or carrying certain strains or like carrying certain people in the world. Or like having to actually carry another person in a relationship or whatever it might be. If you've got back problems, hip problems, tightness of the hips and stuff. Emotionally, it's linked to trauma, sexual trauma and things like that as well too. All those different things play a part. And I think what breathwork does is ultimately it kind of, it gets you out of the logical, rational, like prefrontal cortex, a part of your brain that most of us are in all the time. It gets you out of that, kind of bypasses that and gets you deeper into the unconscious and the subconscious, and you can start to access different information and you can start to let go of certain things. And when you're out of that logical, rational, judgmental self, then emotion becomes something that just comes up that wee bit easier. And you're able to start releasing stuff that you've maybe suppressed for a long time.
So like people that are maybe having health issues with their bodies that they maybe don't know, the breath work has the potential to open up that part of themselves and release the emotion?
It has a potential for you to just release emotion. Yeah, it has a potential for you to just like how, especially men, like how many times, like, you know, would you grow up maybe being told that you shouldn't cry and you should be tough and you should be this and you should be that? And that's your view of the world, and that's who you try to become, and you've suppressed a lot of stuff. I've seen loads of guys, including myself, fucking just bawl out in tears after breathwork sessions. Just let it all go. Mm. And then feel completely different after it.
Yeah.
And it's just like this, whoa. I do online breathwork. I haven't done it in a while now, but I used to do it with a friend of mine, Pat Dovely. And like after some of my sessions, I'm just like flooded.
Yeah.
Flooded in tears, but not in a sad way. But it's like, boom, I'm just letting stuff go.
Yeah.
I'm letting shit go that needs to come out. And for me, that's a good thing. When you're able to actually be in a safe space, you're being in and around other people who are going to help and support you at that time, and you can let that go.
Yeah. I've actually done breath work, and I took some mushrooms, psilocybin, before I'd done it, and fucking hell, I was bawling. What happened in that moment is, I don't know, I don't even know why I was crying, but it was releasing, and it fucking felt so good.
Yeah.
Whatever was, it was just coming out of me.
Yeah.
I'd done this, I don't know, I can't remember the breath work, really good breath work, but I did not anticipate that at all. But whatever it does, the mushrooms relax the emotional body, and then it just came out of me.
Yeah. I've done the same. I've done breath work with psilocybin as well too. Had a different experience where I thought it was just fucking, the music was outstanding, and I was just, it was unbelievable. What an experience. It felt really, really good. I've done other mushrooms experiences as well too, but yeah, I think they all have their part. Do you know what I mean? But breath work, not even from the emotional standpoint and anything like that, and releasing certain things, learning how to breathe properly, like in terms of the impact that it has on your health, is amazing. Like, most people are predominant mouth breathers, and they breathe through the mouth constantly. Sleeping, they breathe through the mouth. Like, I have to ensure that I tip my mouth every night. Otherwise, I'm doing the same. I'm breathing through my mouth. But you should be breathing through your nose at all times. You have nitric oxide in your nose. Nitric oxide is 100 times more present in your nose than it is in your mouth. And nitric oxide acts as a vasodilator, so it opens up your blood vessels. So when you breathe through the nose, you actually oxygenate your blood better. So you're getting more oxygen in the blood around the system because it acts as a vasodilator. So you're getting more oxygen breathing through your nose. You're actually getting it filtered as you breathe through your nose as well too. And when you use the diaphragm properly as well too, and you're breathing through your nose, then there's studies that say that you're actually circulating the air into the lower part of your lungs better, where most people are breathing high in the chest. And when you're breathing high in the chest and you breathe through the mouth, what are you triggering? You're triggering the sympathetic nervous system, which is a fight or flight freeze response. And what are most people all day, every day anyway? Living in their sympathetic nervous system, fight or flight, freeze, anxious. So by learning how to breathe that bit better and actually controlling your own nervous system through the power of your breath, you're improving your health and your physiology, and you're improving your psychology because of it as well. So if you had a practice every morning that you sat down and you did maybe 20 to 30 deep breaths in through the nose, use the diaphragm, push the belly, and like feel that coming right under your chest, and then breathe out. If you did that 3 times, 30 breaths 3 times every single morning, you don't think you'd feel different? 100%. You go outside that door feeling different, feeling more balanced, how do you think your day is going to be?
Yeah,
it's going to be a whole lot fucking better, 100%. But it's things that we just disregard and don't take into account.
Yeah, it's simple things.
Yeah.
You know, just our health.
Yeah.
It's funny that you mentioned that. Recently, I started doing 30 breaths in the shower with cold water, and I found it amazing.
Yeah.
You know, last thing
maybe before you get into the shower would probably be a cipher thing.
Before you get into the shower?
Yeah, you don't want to do it around water. Like, you never know if you passed out or whatever. Now, in the shower, likelihood of anything really happening is probably very low. But doing breath work in a pool or in water isn't a good practice at all, because you can hyperventilate, you can pass out pretty fast and then drown.
You also talked about, I think it was Bufa?
No, Wachuma.
Oh, you talked about Wachuma?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did that.
Yeah, can you tell me a bit about that experience?
Did it last May in Mayo. A friend, again, I mentioned him already, a friend of mine, Pat Dovely, messaged me about putting together a group of around 10 men. I'd always been intrigued about doing plant medicine, and I was looking at ayahuasca and things like that. And then he'd mentioned to me about Wachuma. And to be honest, I hadn't really heard of it. So I started looking at it and researching it and looking at different people that have done it and digging into it a wee bit more. And I says, I put my name down, I'll come and do it. So we did it in Mayo, last May. And I was very fucking apprehensive going down and scared. And I mean, like, the drive down on my own to Mayo was like, there was a guy supposed to go down with me, and he pulled out last minute. So I had a battle in my head the whole way down, thinking, what am I doing? Fucking, like, other than Pat and another guy, a friend of mine, Kieran, I didn't know anybody else. And you've got all these wee things going on in your head going down. But I've still committed to going down anyway. Went down, got to meet everybody. We did kind of like the initiation process the night before. We did the different medicines, and we did the, what's the name of the stuff again? They're using the pipe. It goes up your
Rappy.
Nose. Rappy. Oh, man. I blew the head immediately. Yeah, that's it tough. Really did. It's and tough. I thought, if that's what this is like, what's tomorrow going to be like? Because my head was busting, to be honest. And I was like, you talk about your breath, controlling your breath. So I was trying to use my breath that time to balance things out. But went to sleep that night, woke up the next day, and then we went through that process of the Wachuma, having the drink. To be honest, it was challenging. It was really, really challenging. But it was powerful as well. It was really, really powerful. It was 10 men there from all over Ireland, different coaches, different backgrounds, all coming together and just being open and being vulnerable and just letting their fucking shit out. You know, there was laughter and tears and hugs and all sorts. Like, it was a powerful, powerful weekend, and we've made good connections with that group as well too, to this day. Like, So the whole experience for, you know, yourself, you've done plant medicines. It wasn't what I was kind of expecting, but it was actually what I needed. For me, a lot of the times at the start, and I've talked about it, I recorded on my own podcast last year. I felt it kind of really emotionally challenging, and a lot of anger come up at the start. And I didn't really know how to process it or what it actually was. And thankfully, Mary, who was there, who was a gem, she was able to come and speak to me and actually help me process it better and make the connections. And I was able to kind of let go of it that bit better then. One of my intentions was, when I went down, that I wanted to stop drinking. I wanted to give up alcohol for good. I've been on I wouldn't say a battle. Well, I suppose it has been. For the last few years, I've kind of been off and on and off and on. And it was always something that I wanted to just not have, like, the need for. So I set that intention as well too when I went down.
So when you set the intention, was that done in the ceremony?
It's done in my mind.
Yeah.
It was done before I went down, like, yeah.
Did you set intentions in the ceremony?
To be honest, everybody did as a group. And yeah, they kind of shared why they wanted to come down and, like, what they were looking to experience from it. My intention was that, and just again, I think for me it was to kind of find clarity in certain things that I was doing, find clarity in the path that I was supposed to be on and who I was supposed to become, and you know, things to become that wee bit clearer for me. And about 6 weeks after that, I just stopped drinking. I haven't had a drop since, and it's been probably that path that's been the easiest. You know, during lockdowns, I was off it before lockdowns for 14 months. Ended up back on it again during lockdown. Off and on, 6 months off, 6 months on. Doing that type of path. And then last year, I was like, right, I would rather just not have the need that I think I need to have it as part of my life. And about 6 weeks after, I stopped it. And to be honest, the last year, it's kind of been that. It's like, nah, just don't feel it anymore. Not saying this is going to be forever, because I've done that. And I've said, never touch the drink again. And then what happens? So this time I've tried to change my perspective on it, where when you're giving up something, what do you naturally do? You create a void, and what do you want to do? You want to fill it. So I've tried to actually see the different side of it, which was, right, well, what do I get the benefit from not drinking? Instead of thinking that I'm losing out and I don't get to go out with my friends and do X, Y, and Z, I can still do that and I wake up fresh the next morning. I'm more productive. I'm going to improve my health and improve my sleep. I start to stack up all the benefits of not drinking instead of thinking that I'm losing out. And it was able to help me.
Yeah, yeah. There are many benefits. Like, I've cut back on drinking too. Like, I rarely have a drink now. But for me, it's just like, the benefit was actually just having 2 hours in the evening, just chilling out in the house, going to bed early, getting up, feeling fresh, you know, like,
that's it.
That's all you need, like.
Yeah, and it's the, you don't actually realize, like, that low-level anxiety that you have, you know, through alcohol. And for me, it was, and that might be even just having a couple of beer every single weekend. And again, I'm not demonizing alcohol at all. Fuck, you want to drink, drink. It's your prerogative, so to speak. But for me, it was just something that I thought, right, I don't actually see the value in this at all. And no, it's deteriorating my mental health. It's like having an impact on my business and the things that I want to do. So no, it just doesn't make sense anymore. But after a couple of months, even 4 to 6 weeks, that wee low-level anxiety that you have with alcohol, it just starts to go. It's gone. And then most people think that they use a drink to go to sleep. You don't actually sleep. I remember listening to Dr. Andrew Huberman. He said, if you relate it to, like, if I come up and hit you with a baseball bat and I put you unconscious, would you say I guess sleeping? That's what alcohol does to your brain. It's a ditchy, but you don't actually sleep. So you're waking up the next day and you haven't had a good night's sleep. The brain's not getting to do its processes of cleaning itself out, etc. And how that makes you feel when you're not, like, you're sleep deprived over a period of time is massive. Like, sleep, if you were to improve anything in your life, sleep would be the number one thing to actually really, really improve, because it impacts all areas. Like.
And is that something that you integrate with your coaching? Or
Yeah. Sleep's massive. Like, for me, it's something that I, like, have become really, really anal about. I track my sleep and sleep data, and I see how long I'm in different stages of sleep, and I have sleep routines in the evening, certain routines in the morning that I do, etc., to make sure that I'm ensuring that I can get the best night's sleep.
Yes. Seamus, we've covered a lot of ground here today. A lot more than I expected. You know, when I talk to you, it's very interesting to hear you go deeper and deeper, and I'm sure there's so much more depth to you, you know, that we could talk all day. But in terms of, like, human behavior and the practices that you have, it sounds like you would have a positive impact on anyone that came to you looking for coaching.
Thank you, Ryan. Yeah, that's the aim. It's is to try and help people. It's to try and help other people discover more about themselves, and see the balance in life and see how, like, they can be a better version. And it's something that, I don't know if it's been there from a young age or, but there's just always been that thread there the whole way through my life. Do you know what I mean? There's always been that thread and everything that I've done, and it's a massive part of who I am and what I do. And I see it as my purpose. I see it as my telos. I see it as something that I'm here to do, is to try and, like, for me, to do it for myself, my family, but also to help other people do as well too, which is discover more about themselves so that they can live a better version of themselves.
Yeah. There's really good value in trying to help other people. I feel like that's what we're here to do as humans, is help each other.
Was it Ram Dass that says we're all just walking each other home?
That's exactly it. I love Ram Dass.
Yeah.
Listening to him. He's very interesting.
Yeah.
But look, Seamus, it's been an absolute pleasure having a conversation with you here today.
I've really enjoyed the conversation as well too, Ryan. Just nice and relaxed and free flowing and good questions. So thank you as well.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of lessons in there for me, even, you know, having the conversation with you is very good. And I'm sure there's other people that will take stuff from this.
Hopefully. Happy days.
I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ryan. Pleasure. Well,
that's all from Seamus Fox. I really enjoyed that, and Seamus is a very interesting man to talk to. He's a lot of insight. I could tell that there were so many more questions that I could ask, and, you know, he could have just kept going deeper and deeper and deeper. He's a very, very deep man. But yeah, that's all. So I hope you enjoyed, and I ask you to remember that you are the infinite creator.